From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Did the Department of Homeland Security use the FBI and federal prosecutors to steal an invention of a group of black IT security experts to protect major defense contractors who were paid by DHS more than $1 billion for software they never produced? Part one of this CPR News exclusive interview about the IRP6 later in this newscast. Monday was the day that was set as the deadline for talks between Iran and the so-called P5 plus one countries. The U.S., U.K., France, Russia, China, and Germany to reach an agreement regarding Iran's nuclear energy program and Western sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Late Monday, a deal was announced, extending the deadline until the middle of next year. We begin with this report from Press TV.
Last-ditch nuclear talks continue between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries in the Austrian capital, Vienna, ahead of Monday's deadline for a final agreement. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has held bilateral talks with his American counterpart John Kerry. A source close to the Iranian team says Kerry and Zarif discussed various scenarios, including how to continue the negotiations. Following his talks with Zarif, the top U.S. diplomat had a bilateral meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The foreign ministers of Iran and Russia have also held their own bilateral discussions. Meanwhile, the French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius has had a working dinner with his American, German and British counterparts, as well as EU coordinator Catherine Ashton. Both Iran and the P5 plus one countries have spoken of gaps in the talks.
It seems that this just isn't about Iran and the P5 plus one. We know, for instance, over the last days that John Kerry has been speaking with the various sides other than the P5 plus one members. For instance, he spoke with his Arab counterparts, the Kuwaiti, UAE, Qatari and Bahraini foreign ministers, among others. Today he had a meeting with Saud al-Faisal, his Saudi counterpart, and that meeting took place, in fact, inside the Vienna airport. So a lot of discussions taking place. And yesterday, I think we had the news that John Kerry also spoke on the phone with Benjamin Netanyahu. So, of course, what Iran calls pressure groups may be hard at work as that deadline draws near.
Let's speak to Kaveh Afrasiabi. He's an author and political scientist, and he joins us from Boston. Many thanks for joining us here on Press TV, Mr. Afrasiabi. Now, one of the sticking points, as our correspondent mentioned as well, was that about the sanctions. Iran wants the sanctions to be completely removed. The West is tabling the option of partially lifting them and gradually removing them over a period of 20 years or so. And then there's Israel, which says instead of removing or lifting any sanctions, more sanctions should be imposed on Iran. What do you make of it?
Well, obviously, there's a significant gap between the Iranian and the Western positions on this issue that need to be resolved in order to have an agreement with the deadline approaching. And hopefully this will materialize, and the parties now being at the cliff of the expiration of the interim agreement can look at the bottom and see that there's so many unwanted consequences of failure that act as brakes on this negative scenario. So I'm moderately optimistic that we will have some sort of either an extension or a general agreement with the details to be worked out in the near future. But with respect to the sanctions, of course, you know, it's illogical for the Americans and other Western powers to demand a lengthy stay of the sanction regime on Iran when Iran is asked to fully comply with all the nuclear demands. And, you know, this is a very sticky issue that goes to the heart of this dispute, because Iran regards these sanctions as unjust and even illegal, and there has to be reciprocity on this matter. Otherwise, you know, things will end in a deadlock and a stalemate that's not in the interest of either side. So hopefully the Americans and others will realize that in order to score a diplomatic victory on this front, they need to be much more flexible than they have shown themselves so far.
All right, and Mr. Afrasiabi, though, what about those special interests, pressure groups such as the Zionist lobby, who have their own agenda when it comes to Iran's nuclear energy program?
Well, we have seen how they have been desperately trying to torpedo this process directly as well as through their mouthpieces and forces of influence in Washington, in the U.S. Congress in particular. And we also have a litany of other third parties in the region and so on that are coalescing to prevent a successful diplomatic breakthrough. And, you know, Saudi Arabia is case in point that has a lot of influence in Washington as well. So, you know, parallel to these diplomatic negotiations, we also see these counter movements by these lobby groups and third parties that, in my opinion, will not succeed because there's a great deal of interest on the part of the international community for the resolution of this unnecessary crisis. Right. And it's not in the interest of these states themselves because of all the trade and economic interests and other geopolitical considerations.
Although all parties and the International Atomic Energy Agency agree that Iran has not developed a single nuclear weapon and does not, in fact, have a program in place to build one, all of the P5 plus one countries, with the exception of Germany, do. As do three of Iran's neighbors, India, Pakistan, and Israel. RT's Oksana Boyko spoke with Ali Hynanen, the former deputy director of safeguards at the IAEA, about the apparent double standard.
Why do we focus so much on suspicions with regards to the Iranian nuclear program and don't notice those rumors about Israeli nuclear program? Shouldn't we focus instead on the regional issue?
Sure, and we are focusing. That's why there is this initiative to create a weapons of mass destruction free zone to the Middle East, which goes beyond even nuclear weapons. And people want also chemical weapons, biological weapons, and their delivery vehicles are part of that. But how to deal with Israel? You can only deal it under this context because Israel has not joined the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So IAEA has no authority to go to do anything at this stage in Israel. Let's look at it in a very common sense point of view. If I speed with a car, I get a fine. If I speed several times with a car, someone takes my license away. I'm not allowed to drive with a car. It's my right to drive with a car, but I have to rehabilitate my driving record. But I cannot go to the police and say that I'm speeding with a car because the other people are speeding. So this is how the international legal system works. And yes, we can concentrate on Israel, but it's not to do with Iran. And believe or not, you know, the last thing which, in my view, Middle East needs at this point of time is additional uranium enrichment capability.
Mr. Hynanen, if
I see already signs to that. Yeah.
If I extend your metaphor, that would mean that Israel is just essentially driving the car without any license, and I think that's that is a much greater transgression and much greater risk than a licensed driver who's had some tickets. Now, on the top of that, we have another member of the international community who has already killed hundreds of thousands through his reckless driving, and yet that member of the international community feels entitled to, pass judgments on what Iran should or not or should not do. I mean, we talk about the international system, but at the end of the day, I think it's all common sense. I mean, international law is one thing, but again, as I said earlier, I think all countries want to be treated equally.
An announcement by the Obama administration of what some are calling another ISIS decapitation, this one in Washington. We have this report from RT.
The U.S. Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, is stepping down after being asked to do so by Barack Obama. The president officially announced Hagel's resignation less than an hour ago. Right, let's get more from Guyana Chichikan, who's in Washington. Guyana, we heard plenty from Obama praising Hagel, but no really specific reasons given as to actually why he's going. What do you know?
President Obama said Chuck Hagel would stay on until he nominates another Secretary of Defense. The president said this was not a decision that Chuck Hagel took lightly, and you bet it was not. Earlier, Chuck Hagel's aides were quoted as saying he did expect to serve throughout the rest of President Obama's term. Administration officials speaking on condition of anonymity said President Obama's decision to remove Chuck Hagel was a recognition that the threat from the Islamic State would require a different kind of skills than those that Mr. Hagel was brought on to employ. At the end of October, Chuck Hagel wrote a memo to the White House with what was said to be a sharp criticism of the administration's handling of the fight against ISIS. In that memo, he asked the administration to clearly define its strategy and specifically how to deal with President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. Later, when the administration sort of floated the idea that it now views Assad's removal as key to fighting ISIS, Chuck Hagel was in Congress saying this.
You could change Assad today, and that's not going to change all the dynamics quickly, certainly in Syria. But who are you going to replace Assad with, and what kind of an army would take on ISIL?
But you know, Chuck Hagel is not the only person who apparently fails to understand or disapproves of the administration's strategy on ISIS. According to a CBS and New York Times poll, 57% of Americans disapprove of how the White House is handling ISIS. One can only imagine what discussions Chuck Hagel had with administration officials behind closed doors. But his removal could be a sign that the White House is preparing for more aggressive foreign policy moves that Chuck Hagel perhaps could not sign on to.
After signing a new agreement with the U.S., allowing it to continue its military action in Afghanistan beyond the original December 31st deadline, a new report suggests the Afghan president has quietly lifted the ban on night raids that his predecessor imposed in 2013. Press TV's Bardi Ahanardar has more.
The report has cited Afghan and U.S. military officials as saying that the Afghan National Army Special Forces units will resume the night raids next year. Based on the report, the raids will in some cases include the remaining American troops in Afghanistan. The news came shortly after U.S. President Barack Obama signed an order authorizing American troops to get involved in combat operations in Afghanistan throughout 2015. Afghanistan has witnessed deadly night raids since the U.S. led invasion in 2001. The raids that often turn into large-scale violent operations were a major source of friction between Washington and former President Hamid Karzai. Well, our correspondent Faisal Khurshid joins us now on the line from the Afghan capital, Kabul, to bring us more details about this recent report about the decision to remove the ban on night raids.
Yes, I think so, because this is a very sensitive issue, and night raids usually cause civilian casualties like airstrikes, and the Afghan people in villages don't want foreign troops to burst into their homes or while they're asleep, something that happened many, many times over the past 13 years, and it was the main source of friction, of course, between Kabul and Washington, but now it remains to be seen if the new the policy of the Afghan President Ashraf Ghani would help him to bridge the gap between the local people and his government. So far, many here in Kabul believe if such nighttime raids continue to cause civilian casualties, it would be a very challenging, it would be a big challenge for the new Afghan administration.
Although the U.S. Senate rejected a bill in 2012 to approve the U.N. Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, at least one senator showed his continuing support for the bill when he took a tour of the UN Center for the Audiovisual and Physically Impaired this past Friday. Stephanie Castro reports from the United Nations.
Don't define somebody by their disability, but define them by their ability, said United States Senator Tom Harkin when taking a tour of the United Nations Center for the Audiovisual and Physically Impaired on Friday. Senator Harkin is the lead advocate for disability rights in the United States Congress. The senator's visit to the Accessibility Center in New York comes after the recent U.S. Senate rejection for the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, CRPD. The convention would establish an international standard for disability rights for an estimated 1 billion people around the world. Senator Harkin spoke passionately about the UN Convention and what it means to him.
Well, it means that we now have a global effort to make things more accessible for everyone, for all persons with disabilities, in education, in transportation, communications, everything. To me, that's what CRPD means. It means raising standards all globally for persons with disability. And if I might add, what we have found, at least in the United States, I'm sure in other countries too, that when you make a system better for a person with a disability, it makes it better for people without disabilities.
Senator Harkin said he would work tirelessly to ensure the U.S. Senate ratification of the CRPD. Stephanie Castro, United Nations.
Although the Senate's 2012 vote was 61-38 to ratify the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the tally fell 6 votes short of the 2/3 needed to ratify. Among those who opposed the treaty was former Senator and Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum, who is himself the father of a developmentally disabled child. Santorum traveled to Capitol Hill before the December 2012 vote to encourage fellow Republicans to vote no. Nations that have signed on to the treaty include China, Iran, and Syria. Opponents had said that Senate approval of the treaty could give the impression that the U.S. accepts how those nations treat their citizens with disabilities. This past Sunday, civilians and non-governmental organizations in Mexico found 4 more mass graves in the ongoing search for 43 students from the Ayotzinapa Teacher Training College who went missing after being shot at and detained by Iguala police on September 26th. Since that date, more than 15 mass graves and dozens of bodies have been found. However, none of the remains found as of yet have been linked to the missing students. The most recent mass graves were found in La Laguna, just west of Iguala, the place where federal authorities say police officers shot at several buses transporting the students, killing 3 of them, along with another 3 civilians, before handing over the 43 survivors to a local narco gang. The NGOs involved in the most recent discovery said they were waiting for authorities to arrive in order to start the forensic investigation. The unearthing of numerous mass graves during the search for the student teachers has raised widespread unrest across the country, as local and federal authorities have yet to provide information or evidence on their fate more than 50 days since the students disappeared. The situation has sparked outrage and protests across Mexico, with wide public distrust in the Mexican Attorney General's assertion that the students were killed and burned in a garbage dump. As all eyes remained fixed on Ferguson, Missouri Monday, with the world waiting for the grand jury's decision in the police killing of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown last summer, news surfaced of yet another police killing of an unarmed, innocent black youth, this one a 12-year-old boy. We have this report from RT.
This time, a 12-year-old boy who was shot in the stomach by a policeman at a playground in Ohio. The youngster later died in hospital. Officers thought he was carrying a lethal firearm, which turned out to be an air gun. This particular type of weapon is powered by compressed gas and fires small, ball-like aluminium or plastic pellets. The boy allegedly refused to put his hands in the air and instead reached into his waistband, which is when one officer pulled the trigger. Twice. Police had been responding to reports of a male brandishing a weapon there. Well, on Facebook, the police say the toy gun had its orange safety indicator removed. Such stickers are required on all imitation weapons so they can be identified as non-lethal. Before the boy was shot, a caller had twice told a 911 operator that the pistol was probably fake.
Back in Ferguson, the grand jury was set to reconvene Monday amid reports that, although the DA had previously promised to release all of the evidence presented to the panel, he now says that he was misunderstood and that the complete record may be withheld from the public. We'll have more on that later this week. The IRP6 are a group of former top-level security officials and information technology experts who developed a program for use by the Department of Homeland Security to coordinate information between and among various local, regional and national police agencies about potential terrorists. After DHS had paid at least 2 major defense contractors at least $1.2 billion and received nothing of value in return, this group of entrepreneurs and their small startup company developed a product, sent it to DHS, and were involved in discussions to tweak it when their offices were raided, their computers taken, and their top officials and programmers indicted, charged with failing to pay the temp agencies they were using, in other words, for not paying their bills. And although even the court and prosecutor referred to the obligation by the company, IRP Solutions, to the temp agency as debt, the IRP 6, 5 black, 1 white, were charged with mail and wire fraud and, after a controversial trial, convicted and sentenced to 7 to 11 years in prison. This is part one of their story.
Well, first of all, Sam Thurman and Cliff Stewart, thank you for joining us. And I'd like you to tell us the story of this software. It's a software company, right? And product that was an innovation, an innovative product, got the attention of the Defense Department. And at the end of the day, six of the members of the company get prosecuted because the company owed some people money, federally prosecuted, and then end up going to prison. Could you tell us about it? It's the IRP 6. We're talking about Gary Walker, David Banks, Clinton Stewart, Kendrick Barnes, Demetrius Harper, and David Zerpolo.
Well, Don, thanks for having us. This is Sam Thurman. As far as the IRP 6 are concerned, yeah, you're absolutely right. The gentlemen were executives in a software development company. Software development company was IRP Solutions Corporation, and they were developing software for law enforcement. And it was a software that would help law enforcement to automate the way they do investigations for all practical purposes, you know, bringing them up to the technology age, if you will. The company was started in 2003. And just a quick overview, in 2005, they were accused of wrongdoing. Now, basically what happened, Don, is the company had incurred debt like any other startup company, and that debt was criminalized. And so in 2005, the company was raided by the FBI. And then between 2005 and 2008, 2009 time period, it took the government two federal grand juries in order to get an indictment. And the case went to trial in 2011. And that's when the gentlemen were convicted in 2011. Now, we can get, you know, drill down further into a lot of the details as to what occurred during that time as well.
You know, a couple things strike me from this. The first is, I guess maybe we could get a description of the nature of the debt. Are we talking about withholding, like tax withholding or things like that, or are we talking about debts to third parties?
Yeah, we're definitely talking about... Go ahead, Sam.
Go ahead, Cliff. No, go ahead, Cliff.
No, I was going to say, this is Cliff Stewart, and I was going to say, Don, we're talking about debt absolutely to third parties. We're talking about corporate-to-corporate contract debt. There are staffing companies involved that help to staff certain IT professionals for our IRP solutions to develop their Silk software. Now, a lot of times, you know, what has been asked, well, why did this company use so many staffing companies? Well, when you look at IT staffing, when you look at development of software for law enforcement, you look at the different aspects of that software. You're talking about security. You're talking about a secure framework that can collaborate and communicate all across the country to all federal law enforcement agencies. You don't just go to a staffing agency that says, hey, you know, we're looking to staff some telemarketers. We're looking to staff a girl for the front desk. We're looking to staff somebody to take notes during a meeting.
You don't go that to Manpower, right? Yeah, you don't go to Manpower for that, right?
Exactly. You don't go to Manpower and say, look, I'm looking, I need 20 people to sit on the phone and call up and try to give people credit cards at 25% APR.
Yeah, right,
That's
yeah,
not
right.
what we're talking about.
Right.
We're talking about IT professionals that have to have security background, that can pass a government security check, that know software development and system architecture to their nth degree to build something like this. So you have to pick and choose. And when you go to a staffing company and say, I need this cybersecurity architect, do you have somebody who fits the bill? you say no, they say no, you say, okay, well, I have another list. I have this person on here, and you get down to, you know, where you say, okay, well, I need somebody like a database developer. They say, yeah, we can provide you that. So you go through the gambit to say, I need all right. these agencies
right.
to provide me with these different skill sets. So this is contracted work that says you provide me, you go headhunting for me, you find the person that can provide, that can do the work. And then what is really crazy about this, none of the money passed through the hands of the IRP solutions executives. These are staffing companies who are paying their contractors. They cut the check to their contractors, not to IRP solutions. Right. So this is the debt. Yeah. And they've never denied that they went in debt trying to build this product for Department of Homeland Security, for New York Police Department and several others. But it's still debt. It's debt between two companies. And the irony of this all is when one of these staffing companies presented the situation to the FBI up in Denver, Colorado, the response from the FBI was that this is a civil matter. You need to try to take this up civilly really? And basically get your money back. This is a debt issue. So then how then did it get criminalized and go to federal court? Makes absolutely no sense.
Right. So let me be clear. First of all, we're talking about a corporation. That's where the company that you worked for is a corporation. The entities Absolutely. that you're contracting with are corporations. The nature of the debt is the kind that can be discharged in bankruptcy, and there's no mm-hmm. criminal liability attached to bankruptcy court unless there's fraud. And then the FBI themselves saying essentially to the people making the complaints, look, we're not in the debt collection business. You know, go yep. to civil court and sue like you're supposed to. And if you wanted to, again, absent fraud, generally you fold the corporation up and that's the end of it. Whatever assets are in the corporation are available to the creditors and that's the end of the story. So how do you end up in federal court facing criminal charges? How do these guys end up in federal court facing criminal charges?
And that's Don,
if I may, and just to kind of even more so add to the unusual abnormalities in this case, two things I want to point out. I mentioned, and this is Sam again, that the business was raided in 2005.
Yeah,
well, prior to that raid, IRP had ongoing visits with the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security actually reached out to IRP Solutions and said that we understand that you're developing software that's going to fit the bill for things that we need to do and that we need to have happen. And you know, at that time, the Department of Homeland Security was a new agency
right.
that was tasked with pulling together all the other federal law enforcement agencies under one umbrella so that another 9/11 would not occur.
Right.
So now that, you know, being said, IRP was also engaged in several meetings with NYPD. So you're talking
right.
two of the largest agencies in the world. And so prior to this 2005 raid, the agent, the FBI agent who executed the raid along with 21, 22 other agents had actually done had gone to these agencies to validate, is IRP Solutions a real company? Do they have a real software? You know, is this legit? You know, what's going on? At the same time, IRP had retired federal agents working as consultants for them who had vouched for the legitimacy of the software and the legitimacy of the company.
Right.
Agent John Smith persisted and still got moved forward and got a judge to sign off on a search warrant stating that IRP was a purported software development company.
We'll have part two later this week. Here's an excerpt.
After 9/11, you know, there was the 9/11 commission. The 9/11 commission report clearly calls out the fact that our nation was sore lacking. I mean, there was no communication between state, federal, and local law enforcement as far as sharing information and collaborating on information. It wasn't so much that these various agencies may not have had various components of information that could have been helpful, but they were not sharing that information. As far as making that happen, there were failed initiatives. You basically have over $1 billion that had been wasted on initiatives that were supposed to help to establish this kind of communication and collaboration and information sharing that did not work. We're talking smoke and mirrors. So there was a lot of money on the table as to, you know, people did have something to gain by pushing a small company like IRP Solutions out of the picture.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.